This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The new movie, Anomalisa, is an existential love story about loneliness and disconnection. This very human story, including its tender love scene, is portrayed by doll-sized, realistic-looking puppets. The movie is made with stop-motion animation. All the sets are handmade miniature versions of the world around us, everything from planes and taxis to a hotel room and city streets. The film was written by Charlie Kaufman, who co-directed it with Duke Johnson. They're both my guests. Kaufman also wrote Being John Malkovich, Adaptation, and Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, and wrote and directed Synecdoche, New York. Johnson directed the Emmy-winning animated episode of the TV series Community. Anomalisa is about a middle-aged man, Michael Stone, who flies to Cincinnati, where he's scheduled to speak to a conference of customer service representatives. Although he's an expert in customer service, he finds it emotionally impossible to connect with anyone, even his wife and child. Everyone looks and sounds the same to him, literally, until he meets Lisa, a woman with a unique face and voice. But it's hard for her to connect because a facial scar has left her feeling disfigured and ugly. So she is astonished when Michael invites her to his hotel room for a nightcap instead of choosing her more attractive friend, Emily. Michael is voiced by David Thewlis, Lisa by Jennifer Jason Leigh.
Most people don't really like to look at me too much because, you know.
I think you're lovely.
No, you don't. I've always done phone work because I'd never get hired to work in a store or a restaurant or...
How did it happen? If it's okay for me to ask.
I don't like to talk about it.
May I kiss you there?
Oh my God. Oh my God, no. Oh God.
Sorry.
You're not like a pervert or something. Like some weird version of a chubby chaser.
No.
I just don't understand why you would want to kiss me there.
Because I like you.
Why? I mean, I'm not smart like Emily, and I'm ugly. You're a really smart guy. You should like Emily. I don't even understand a lot of the words in your book. I sat there with the dictionary. I try to learn, but I'm never going to be smart. And I'm ugly.
I find it enormously charming that you read any book with a dictionary next to you.
And that's a scene from Anomalisa. Charlie Kaufman, Duke Johnson, welcome to Fresh Air. Charlie Kaufman, let me start with you. How would you describe Michael Stone's state of mind? He wants to connect, but everyone looks and sounds the same to him, with the exception of Lisa.
Yeah. His state of mind, I guess, is an inability to connect with people. I don't know other than that what to say. I mean, he's a depressed person, and he's obviously very lonely because of this, and very frustrated, and I think angry.
He stays at the Fregoli Hotel. So, of course, I Googled Fregoli, and there's actually something called the Fregoli delusion, which is, Charlie, you want to describe the delusional belief that's given the name Fregoli?
Yeah, it's a belief that everyone else in the world is the same person in disguise.
It's one person disguising themselves as all these other people?
Yes, it's usually a result of some sort of organic or traumatic brain problem. And in this movie, I used it kind of metaphorically. I wasn't intending for Michael to actually have this condition, but it interested me. The name comes from an Italian quick change artist who apparently, because he's very, I think it was from maybe the late 19th century, early 20th century, so I don't think there's any record of it, but apparently he was amazing at changing his costumes on stage immediately in front of people without them understanding how he did it.
And how did you find out about this?
I have a tendency to read about syndromes. And so, you know, I mean, I look up things like that, and I'm fascinated by them, you know, as actual things in the world, but they also seem psychologically interesting to me to utilize.
So you have all the characters, with the exception of the two characters that we heard, the rest of the characters are all voiced by Tom Noonan. And it's very disorienting at the beginning of the movie because a woman's speaking, but you're hearing Tom Noonan's voice, and then you realize, gee, Tom Noonan's voice seems to be like every voice. And then you start to understand that you're seeing and hearing things from the main character's point of view. It's a really interesting decision for you to have made, to have all the characters, with the exception of Michael and Lisa, have the same voice.
Yeah, I mean, the reason that I came to this is because it was originally a radio play or a staged radio play, and I was trying to utilize voices in kind of an interesting way, and it was a very low-budget production. I could only afford, you know, to cast three actors. So I thought, you know, what if one person plays all the other people? And, you know, I'd read about the Fregoli thing, and it seemed to sort of lend itself to it. So that's where it originally came from. And, of course, it carried over into the film. And the faces are all the same as well, which was not an issue in the play, but is something we decided on here.
So another part about the story I want to ask you about before we get to the animation. The character of Michael is a customer service guru. You know, he's written a self-help book for customer service agents. He's giving a speech at a customer service conference. And the speech he makes, I just want to play a short excerpt of it, is really fascinating because it's like he knows all the platitudes about customer service, about always smiling and, you know, recognizing that everybody is unique. But this speech becomes for him this kind of like existential crisis that he's bringing all these other things into. So I just want to play an excerpt of the opening of his speech to the customer service representatives.
Always remember the customer is an individual, just like you. Each person you speak to has had a day. Some of the days have been good, some bad, but they've all had one. Each person you speak to has had a childhood. Each has a body. Each body has aches. What is it to be human? What is it to ache? What is it to be alive? I don't know. What is it to ache? I don't know. What is it to be alive? I don't know.
Okay, not the kind of self-help pep talk you'd expect at a customer service conference. Charlie, to prepare for that, did you read the platitudinous self-help books in addition to thinking about the more existential things you wanted to get in there and the kind of just like mental health issues the character's having?
No, not really. I have a lot of experience in customer service. I did customer service work for probably a decade. So when I decided to give Michael that job, I did it for a couple of reasons, because I had the experience, but also because I thought it was funny that there would be somebody out there whose career this would be. To be a customer service guru. I subsequently found out that there actually is somebody out there. I heard him on NPR who goes around and talks about it. So I thought I invented it, but I didn't. I didn't. I mean, you know, I didn't really have to do much research.
What kind of customer service rep were you?
I worked at the Roundabout Theater dealing with subscribers. I worked at the Metropolitan Opera selling tickets. I worked at the Star Tribune in Minneapolis answering customer complaints about delivery.
Animation seems perfect for this story because it's about a character who's trapped in his head, who's not living in the real world, and is kind of having a dissociative experience. Do you both see it that way, that this is, because it's kind of going on in someone's head, that to be able to create the world from scratch is a good opportunity?
I think that there's something about this type of animation that communicates fragility and humanity and brokenness in a way that other types don't necessarily, because it's all handmade and because it's an imperfect process. You can see the signs of the animators. You can see the remnants of them on the puppets. You can see the way the puppets move, but you can also see chatter on the clothing where the animators have moved them. You can see it in the hair. The type of face construction that we use to animate the faces is called replacement animation. And those faces are replaceable. There's many, many different versions of the lower part of the face and many, many different versions of the upper part of the face. And you can, you know, mix and match them to create all of the mouth movements and all of the expressions. And this type of animation is not something we invented. It's been done before. It was done on Coraline. But when it's done, in other movies, they'll paint out the seams in post-production. And we decided right away to keep them because we didn't want to conceal what this thing is.
Can you explain the kind of stop-motion animation that you use in this movie and how everything in the movie is handmade, from the airplane and the taxi cab to the people to the hotel room, the cityscape? Everything is just miniatures that have been made by artists and animators.
That's correct. We fabricate everything. Everything that you see on the screen is made by hand. It's all in 1/6 scale, which is a Barbie's scale for a frame of reference. So all the locations and sets and cars and it all exists in real three-dimensional space. None of it actually physically moves in real time. Everything is static and the puppets are posed in various static positions in a sequence over the course of a series of frames. And when the frames are played back in real time, it creates the illusion of movement.
Kind of like, what are they called? The flip things.
Flip books,
like a
or
flip
a zoetrope.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think this form of animation where everything is handmade in three dimensions and then shot frame by frame is perfect for the story of this film, because for the main character, everything and everybody looks the same to him. So he's living in this like humdrum, drab world that he can't seem to escape from. He's in a generic plane, in a generic taxi, a generic hotel room. But because of how it's all handmade in the movie, everything looks kind of miraculous to you as a viewer of the film. So you have this kind of tension of the humdrum mundane and the miraculousness of everything being handmade. And it's just a really interesting constant tension between the two. It reminds me, excuse me for being corny, it reminds me of life itself, where sometimes like just walking outside seems like, ugh, another gray day, you know, things are so boring. And other times you walk outside and just like everything seems like a miracle.
Yeah, I know what you mean. And we think that it allows people to focus and pay attention to things that are mundane in a way that they might not be able to in live action. I mean, somewhere in your mind as an audience member, you know that everything that you see has been calculated and choreographed, that there's no accident, that if he drums his fingers against his thigh, that was a choice that we made as filmmakers. And it becomes kind of fascinating because of that.
Duke, when you're shooting these, was it 1/6 size?
That's 1/6 correct,
ratio?
Yeah.
So everything is like 1/6 of the size it would be in reality.
I was just going to say Michael is our tallest character. He's 12 inches, and that's the equivalent of being 6 feet tall.
So what kind of camera do you use when you're shooting everything in miniature like that?
It's just a still camera, you know, a camera that's typically used for taking photography, you know, mm-hmm. still images, because that's what it is. That's what we work in is static images.
So just so we can visualize how this is done, are all the sets like on a table or are they on the floor? What kind of angle does the photographer have to get to be able to realistically shoot these miniature sets?
Yeah, so basically we have a big empty warehouse where stages are created, different stages. In our case, we had 18 that are separated by sheets of duvetyne that are hung from the ceiling. So you have these sort of black rooms created out of this duvetyne fabric that's used in filmmaking because it has no bounce quality for light. Like if you create a room out of duvetyne, there's total blackness and you have a blank slate to introduce light and create the atmosphere of your choosing. So you have separate rooms divided by this black fabric, and they're anywhere from 15 feet by 15 feet to 40 feet by 20 feet or something. And there's a set in each one of these stages, and there's an animator. And, you know, for something like the hotel room, in our case, the hotel room is a large part of the film. So we had to build several hotel rooms. We had 8, and they would be on various stages, and sometimes different parts of the same scene would be animated simultaneously by different animators on multiple stages because the process moves so slowly. It can often take weeks or months to animate a single shot. What happens is we go in and you pose the puppets, you sort of stage it as you would with live action, and then you set the camera angle and you secure it into place, typically with glue. You actually glue the camera into place so that it doesn't move and you can't bump it over time, and then the cinematographer lights it, you know, just like you would a live action set, but it's just on a miniature scale. It almost looks like a blueprint or a diagram of a live action set.
So you actually glue the camera in place so you have the exact same setup for shot after shot after shot, so it looks like live action even though it's a series of still photographs.
Yeah, that's exactly right, because, you know, the shots take a long period of time. So if you're just going to do like an over-the-shoulder close-up of a character, you know, you could just set that up on a tripod and shoot it if it was live action. But this camera is going to have to sit here for days and days and days, and anything could happen. You know, an animator's animating a shot, and then they could bump it with their elbow, which often happens, actually, and you have to sort of animate the camera back into place. Everything is glued down, actually, in stop motion. All the furniture in the set, they're actually glued into place, and then they have to be freed up from the glue if a character were to interact with it.
The models for the main characters are not the actors who voice those characters. So how did you decide who the models would be? Because you needed models so that you could see how that face looks when it moves. How does that face look when it's sad or when it's happy or when it's sleeping? Charlie, how did you decide who to cast as the models for the puppets?
Originally, we went to stop-motion character designers and were looking for drawings. We wanted these to be naturalistic, and it seemed to be very difficult for the people that we went to kind of come back with drawings that reflected that. They always had a kind of a caricature-ish, you know, most stop-motion animation, the puppets have very large eyes and, you know, very big hands, and they kind of gesture in very broad ways, and there's practical reasons for that. But, you know, we'd say we want this to look not like that. We didn't want it to be a kid's movie. We didn't want it to have that kind of cartoonish quality to it, and we weren't really getting the drawings that we wanted. So we started to look for real people that could represent the characters, and we looked online, you know, at middle-aged men and 30-some-odd-year-old women, and weren't really finding anything that jumped out at us. What happened is that Duke thought of his ex-brother-in-law and showed us a picture, and he was perfect for Michael. So he was brought in, and he became the model for Michael. And then Lisa was somebody that our producer, Rosa Tran, spotted in a restaurant in Los Angeles, and you know, she was approached and asked if she would be a model for this character, and she agreed. So they were photographed making different facial expressions and different mouth movements, and their bodies were changed a bit. Lisa is heavier than this woman. Then once we had these photographs, we had a sculptor named Carol Koch come in and interpret them out of clay, and that's how it happened.
One of the really difficult things that the animators had to do was animate Michael's naked body. And there's a scene it's actually kind of funny. He's in his hotel room and he takes off his clothes and goes into the shower. And as happens so frequently in a shower in a hotel where you haven't stayed before, you don't know which direction is hot and which direction is cold and how to set the water. So, you know, first it's way too cold and then it's way too hot. And he's just like really angry at the shower until it gets just right. And then he steps out of the shower and you see, you know, a full frontal naked body. And it is so realistic looking. And you even see as he moves, you see his genitals gently move back and forth in the way that they do in real life. And I can't imagine how, like, technically complicated that must have been, considering you're working with little Barbie doll-sized puppets. How do you get that kind of anatomically correct movement?
Well, you know, these animators are particularly skilled in understanding biology and physics and how things move. We intentionally design these puppets to feel like real people in the sense that they have average bodies. That plays a big part into the authenticity of the moment. They don't look, you know, like they're modeled after some iconic form or archetype. It's just sort of average and asymmetrical and irregular and specific. You know, there was one animator that was asked to animate that moment, and he decided that he couldn't do it because he felt that the main character resembled his father and that would be too awkward for him to do. But it is particularly difficult to animate a naked puppet because the puppet itself, there's no clothing or material to sort of hide behind. You can see the body, it's there, it's exposed, and every subtle movement will be realized by the audience. That particular moment is difficult because he's wet when he gets out of the shower, and that wetness is a type of a lubricant that has to be consistently added every frame or every sequence of frames because it dries over time. You know, his body has hair in it, and the hair isn't actually animatable, so you have to sort of move the body without disturbing the hair. You know, all of these subtle features, but just trying to get naturalistic movements and make it look like it's really existing in space, like it has the proper amount of gravity and weight and movement.
There's a beautiful lovemaking scene in this, and it starts off very awkward and becomes quite tender. And you're not thinking, oh, that's so silly, two puppets making love, ha, ha, ha. You're thinking, oh, two people are finally connecting and experiencing pleasure in a way that they haven't been able to before. And they're experiencing a moment of joy. And you see what they're doing to each other, but it's not like graphic sex. It's not like explicit sex. So I'm interested in how you managed to animate that scene so that people would not have the reaction of like, that's hilarious, puppets having sex.
We were aware going into this, you know, of Team America and the idea of puppet sex being funny.
It was hilarious in that.
Yeah, and it was, but that was not our purpose with the scene. So we knew that was going to be the expectation going into this. And certainly that scene has gotten a lot of attention. It's been written about a lot. So people are really interested in the idea of puppets having sex. But, you know, our goal was to follow Michael and Lisa from the point that they entered the hotel room through this moment to the point where the lights go out and the scene is over as one continuous thing and not betray them by making a joke out of this. And so really it was just a matter, well, not just, but it was a matter of being very hyper aware of what each of them was thinking at each moment leading up to that scene and through that scene. And it all had to be choreographed with the intent of it being true and that if there is humor in the scene, it comes out of the moments between them that are organic to the characters, to the awkwardness and the, of being with somebody for the first time.
How did you deal with the ratings for the movie? I mean, because it is a sexual scene. Did that affect the rating that you got, even though it's puppets and not people?
We were hoping for an R rating. There could have been things we might have done that would have given us an NC-17 that we, you know, decided that we wouldn't do. We didn't know if we were going to get an R or not, but we'd hoped for that. And they gave us an R rating without really any conversation. So, as you mentioned, it's not a very graphic scene.
As anatomically correct as your puppets are, when they walk, they have a slouch and a shuffle that looks not quite as realistic as their other aspects, like their facial expressions and other movements. Was that intentional?
Well, we discussed Michael's character early on as you know, he's typically, when puppets are made, they'll be sculpted in sort of a neutral position with their arms splayed out and their shoulders back and, you know, everything kind of in a straight line. But we built Michael's character into his neutral sculpt. He's middle-aged, he's a little overweight, he's got rounded shoulders, his head hangs low. He has a naturally furrowed brow, and he walks with a certain weight. He's, throughout the film, actually, he's always a little drunk. He's drinking from the moment he's introduced in the film, you know, pretty much all the way through. So there's that element as well. I'll just add that walking in stop-motion animation is probably the most difficult thing you can do, because a lot of times when a character is sitting or they're just standing still and you're moving their upper body and their face and their head, they're grounded to a source, but when they're moving, their whole body moving through space, there's so many elements to consider. There's the arcs of the movement and the weight and the compression of their feet against the ground. And the way that they have these puppets connect to the set is they actually drill a hole in the set and they put a threaded rod up through that hole and screw it into the bottom of their foot. And that keeps them in place. And then with every step they take, they have to lift that foot up and patch that hole and drill another hole. And actually, for every step, there's two holes that are drilled, because they have a hole in their heel and a hole in the ball of their foot, so that they can have the heel to toe movement of an actual footstep. So it's extremely complicated, and only a few animators can actually do it really well.
There's a scene in the hotel where Michael puts on the TV, and the TV is showing an old movie, like from the 1930s. Instead of him watching real actors in this movie, the actors in the movie are puppets too, just like all the other characters in the film. So, like, you're filming a 1930s. Is it a real movie that we're seeing? Is it like a puppet version of a real movie?
Yeah, it's My Man Godfrey. It's an exact replica of that scene.
So we're watching puppet versions of Carol Lombard and William Powell in this 1930s film. That's something really hilarious about that, that you're taking these puppets based on those actors, having them do things that they do in a classic film, shooting it on film, then putting that film on TV and having a puppet watch it.
Yes, it is all of that.
I just love the obsessive nature of that. Charlie, how did you decide that there needs to be a movie that he's watching so that you could do like a puppet movie within the puppet movie?
Well, you know, I'm trying to recreate what it's like to be alone in a hotel room, which I have a lot of experience with. And so I'm thinking of things that happen in a hotel room, and I thought of that. And it was originally Casablanca in the stage version, but we couldn't afford the rights to that. So we chose this because we were looking for something iconic, but that wasn't expensive. And this happened to be in the public domain.
Charlie, you mentioned you've spent a lot of time alone in hotel rooms. Did you want this hotel room to evoke any particular hotel rooms? I feel like I've stayed in the hotel room that's in your movie, but it looks like so many hotel rooms. That's why I feel that way.
Yeah, that's what we wanted. We wanted, as soon as the bellhop opens the door and we see the room for the first time, we wanted people in the audience to go, "I've been in this room." So
yeah, and it's a nice room.
It's a nice room. It's a decent room at a kind of a business hotel, probably.
with a minibar.
Has a minibar, yeah, it has little paintings and photographs in it, and they're all hand-painted.
It's a really minibar.
Yeah. Oh my gosh, yeah, it must be like super mini. So just thinking, like, what are some of the things, Charlie, that have always struck you about being alone in a new hotel room while you're on the road that you wanted to put in the movie?
Room service. You know, you get there, you've spent all this time, usually hours and hours on a plane, and you get into the room, and it's your destination. You know, you've, like, been aiming for that that room for hours, and then you get there, and you don't know what to do with yourself, you know? And
yes.
You just sit there, or you think, oh, I guess I'll go out now and walk around.
And then there's always the thing where you look at yourself in the bathroom mirror of the hotel, and you always look a little different there because the lighting is not what you're used to. And
yeah, I'm hoping for good lighting, and I'm really disappointed if it's really bad fluorescent lighting. The other thing that I've noticed about mirrors in hotel rooms is that they make me look a lot skinnier, and I don't know if that's an intentional thing, but I imagine it must be. I look really like trim and svelte, which makes me happy.
There's a scene in the movie where the woman who's voiced by Jennifer Jason Leigh, and who is certain that she's ugly and therefore unlovable, Michael asks her to sing a song because he thinks she's really special, and she says she likes to sing but only when she's alone. And he kind of like convinces her to sing. And she sings Girls Just Want to Have Fun. But there's such melancholy in the song. It's like the saddest version ever of Girls Just Want to Have Fun. She sings it from the point of view of somebody who would love to have fun but probably never has, and fears that she never will. She wants to be the one who walks in the sun, but is confident she never will. Charlie, how did you choose that song and decide to find the sadness within it?
In the play, it was a different song. It was My Heart Will Go On from Titanic, and we couldn't afford it. So we were scrambling to find something else for Lisa to sing. It was actually, we were already at the recording session, so, and we hadn't decided on what it was going to be yet, and we had ideas of songs that might work, and Girls Just Want to Have Fun is one of them. And so at the time, you know, there's an uncertainty about which way to go because it was this other thing before. But once Jennifer sang it and we realized, you know, what the significance of it is for her character, and you know, with the way Jennifer did it, it became clear to us that that was the song to use. And, you know, that's the way Lisa would sing it. So we had her do it that way.
So we can't play that song for our audience because we don't have it here to play. But we can play for our listeners the song that closes the movie, which I really love. It's called None of Them Is You. And again, just for listeners just joining us, this movie is about a middle-aged man for whom the world has become a very drab place, and he sees everybody as being the same person. Nobody is differentiated, with the exception of this one character, Lisa. And so the closing song speaks to that. It's sung by Tom Noonan, who does most of the voices in the film. And Charlie, you wrote the lyric. Carter Burwell, who did the score for the movie, wrote the music for the song. I love hearing non-singers sing.
Yeah, I like Tom's voice, his speaking voice and his singing voice. And yeah, I like the kind of roughness of it.
I want to thank you both so much and congratulate you on the film. Duke Johnson, Charlie Kaufman, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Let's listen to Tom Noonan singing the closing song from Anomalisa.
When I see a face or hear a name or am introduced to someone new, it doesn't matter, they're all the same, and none of them is you. When I go to work or take a walk and watch what other people do, I'll listen to their idle talk, and none of them is you. Where are you, my dear? at night, I'll pass the time.
Music from the new film Anomalisa. Charlie Kaufman and Duke Johnson directed the film. Charlie Kaufman also wrote it. Two 1950s telecasts of the musical Peter Pan, both starring Mary Martin, have been released on Blu-ray. Lloyd Schwartz will review them after a break. This is Fresh Air.